Up is the news.
The headlines: leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution highlights the peaceful nature of Iran's nuclear program and says the country will face a pressing need for nuclear energy in the future. U.S. police in New Jersey are under fire for their racially motivated response to a scuffle between two teens, one black and the other white. The Canadian police warn truck drivers blockading downtown Ottawa to leave or face arrest as a minister says extremist groups are helping organize protests. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story: leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, rejects Western claims that Iran is seeking a nuclear weapon, once again confirming that Tehran's nuclear program is entirely peaceful. Ayatollah Khamenei also noted that Iran will further develop its peaceful nuclear capacity to maintain its independence. Sooner or later, the leader added, the Islamic Republic will be in need of nuclear energy. Ayatollah Khamenei recalled that he had cautioned the negotiators to include certain points in the initial deal when it was being drawn up back in 2015, but that those cautions were not heeded and therefore led to subsequent problems. Iran's leader said the chief purpose of the sanctions is to weaken the Islamic Republic. He pointed out to production, collective efforts, and diplomacy as a way forward to neutralize the effects of economic pressure and sanctions. Iran's top negotiator in the Vienna talks is calling on other parties to be realistic and avoid excessive demands. In a tweet, Ali Barikani says it's time for them to take, quote, serious decisions in order to restore the 2015 accord. The diplomat says the months-long negotiations are closer than ever to an agreement. However, he stresses that nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. Russia's representative to the talks, Mikhail Ulyanov, has echoed Barikani's remarks, calling for final decisions to be made. Advisor to Iran's negotiating team in the Vienna talks, Mohammad Marandi, says no matter who's in charge in Washington, U.S. policies indicate that it's an unreliable partner in any talks.
The United States can't be trusted, nor can the Europeans be trusted, because we've seen that the Europeans do whatever the United States tells them to do, whether it's Obama, when he warns financial institutions, insurance companies, shipping companies, major investment corporations not to deal with Iran. That was a violation of the nuclear deal, and the Europeans went along with it. When Trump tore up the deal, the Europeans nagged about it, but they went along with it. Under Biden, the Europeans continue to pursue Trumpian maximum pressure sanctions. We have to keep in mind that as we speak, maximum pressure sanctions against women and children continue to be implemented both by the Europeans and the Americans. So under such circumstances, there's no reason for anyone in Iran to trust the Europeans or the Americans about their nuclear commitments, about their commitments to the nuclear deal, nor can the Iranians trust them about with regards to any other form of negotiations. When the Europeans and the Americans are seen as unreliable partners within the JCPOA, then how can other issues that go beyond the nuclear program be discussed with these countries in the hope that an agreement would be respected by the Europeans and the Americans?
Israel's state has carried out yet another strike on Syria, targeting a town near the capital, Damascus. A Syrian military source says a missile attack has caused material damage. Our Damascus correspondent, Mohammed Ali, has given us more details about the raid.
So an official military source said in a statement that there has been a new Israeli attack on Syria. What happened was that about 11:35 p.m. local time, Israel carried out an attack using surface-to-surface missiles launched from the occupied Syrian Golan. Those missiles targeted the Syrian army positions around a small town called Zakia in the southern part of Damascus, causing only material damage. Now, this is what the official military statement here is said. This attack comes just about a week following a similar one that hit also the capital, Damascus, and killed a soldier and injured several others. Now, also this attack, it's very important to say that it comes just one day following a visit by the Russian Minister of Defense to Damascus. And also this attack comes despite the strong condemnation which the Russian Minister of Defense expressed over the previous Israeli attack that happened on the 9th of this month, in which at that time the Russian Ministry of Defense said that such an Israeli attack is definitely a blatant violation of Syrian sovereignty and will lead to an escalation of the situation.
U.S. law enforcement is once again facing accusations of double standards. Now a video showing officers' response to a fight between two black and white teens has rekindled fears of racial bias. The footage shows the teenagers are arguing in a mall in New Jersey, and police arrive to break up the brawl. Officers then tackle the black boy to the ground and handcuff him, while the white teen is seated on a couch and looks on. Social media users have reacted to the police behavior and slammed it as racially motivated. The New Jersey governor has described the situation as racially disparate treatment by police. Anti-racism sentiments have remained high in the U.S. following several high-profile cases of police brutality against black Americans, including the murder of George Floyd back in 2020. Police in the Canadian capital vow to further crack down on truckers that are blocking downtown Ottawa over COVID-19 restrictions. Police now warns the truckers to clear the area or face arrest. The federal public safety minister blames extremist groups for helping organize the protests. Marco Mendocino says some actors want to overthrow the government. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has invoked little-used emergency powers to end the prolonged protests. The extraordinary move has sparked criticism, with one opposition politician calling it, quote, a hammer on Canadians. Tens of people have been arrested following Trudeau's announcement on Monday. The protesters have blocked several U.S.-Canada border crossings and clogged streets across the country. Although protests launched by truckers in Canada known as the Freedom Convoy may have subsided, protesters are still out there forcing Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to take an unprecedented move. The Premier enacted an emergency COVID-related order usually associated with national security issues. However, there's been a contagion effect with protests now spreading to other parts of the world, including the U.S., New Zealand, Australia, and France.
The government of Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is in trouble. His cabinet has invoked a rarely used emergency ordinance to quell anti-vaccine truck protests that have crippled the country. The Emergency Act can authorize the use of the military. It can also temporarily suspend citizens' rights to free movement or assembly, and the government is taking steps to stop financial support of illegal protests. The measure allows Canadian banks to freeze accounts suspected of funding the blockades and suspend insurance on vehicles in the protests. Trudeau has noted that the measures will be time-limited, geographically targeted, as well as reasonable and proportionate. The Canadian law, which was passed in 1988, says, for the purpose of this act, a national emergency is an urgent and critical situation of a temporary nature that cannot be effectively dealt with under any other law of Canada. Trudeau said the government is not overriding the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, nor limiting the right to peaceful assembly.
The federal government has invoked the Emergency Act to supplement provincial and territorial capacity to address the blockades and occupations.
The plan has drawn widespread condemnation from Canadians, including the Premier in Quebec, Francis Legault, who said Trudeau's announcement risked putting oil on the fire. The trouble all began after thousands of protesters in trucks and other vehicles blocked the streets of Ottawa, as well as two border crossings with the U.S. to vent their frustration over COVID-19 vaccine mandates. The protests have not stayed in Canada, though. Similar freedom convoy protests have grown in countries like the US, France, New Zealand, Australia. As Commonwealth protests, many have also vented their anger against the government due to their economic situation as a result of COVID-19.
Spontaneous thing where people are upset. That's one whole part of this, and it's part of a general movement, I think, that we're seeing around the world of the ultra-right asserting itself and using the money of the millionaires to do it.
The Freedom Convoy protests are not just about COVID-19 restrictions like lockdowns or cross-border checks. The anger is due to the impact of these laws. They've hindered, slowed down, or in many cases blocked the workflow, especially when it comes to supply chains. This has on many occasions led to a loss of revenue.
The so-called Freedom Convoy protest started with truckers protesting COVID-19 vaccine or quarantine mandate. It then broadened to include people opposing all coronavirus-related restrictions announced by the Trudeau government. The protest has attracted the support of thousands of Canadians, even some who are fully vaccinated. They say all COVID-19 preventive measures must be dropped. The protests have drawn support from groups from the U.S.
Jabbing is a right-wing attack on all kinds of things, because one of the demands of the people in Canada was that Trudeau should resign, and the other was that the western part of the country should secede. So, you know, these are not just little political things. So you have, in Canada in particularly, the implementation of a very conservative right-wing agenda. And everybody agrees on that, especially the right-wing who's doing it. So this isn't just some kind of, you know, spontaneous thing where people are upset.
Canadian authorities have said about half of the funding for the protests has come from U.S. supporters. Toronto Dominion Bank last week froze two personal bank accounts that received $1.4 million for the protests. In the western Canadian province of Alberta, police have broke up a group that was armed and prepared to use violence. The protests that have hindered traffic at border crossings have impacted more than $500 million in commerce each day.
I think that what happened was that the automobile companies complained. You know, there's production shut down, millions of dollars lost. And it was pretty clear that that was very unpopular. And he waited long enough for the economy to be heard and people to be heard and said, enough's enough. And I think the balance of force has changed a bit because of that.
Truckers and their supporters have gathered in the capital, Ottawa, since January 29th to rally against mask mandates, lockdowns, restrictions on gatherings, and other COVID-19 preventive measures. Some downtown Ottawa businesses have had to shut down temporarily. There have been reports of rock throwing, property damage, harassment, and even hate crimes.
A number of British Muslim teaching staff are demanding a new public inquiry after an investigative podcast revealed that government ministers may have fueled an Islamophobic purge based on a fabricated extremism plot. The notorious Trojan horse affair rocked Britain in 2014 and led the way for the hostile anti-Muslim climate which affects ordinary British Muslims today. Robert Carter headed to Birmingham to speak to victims of what is now called a witch hunt.
British Muslim victims of a government-backed anti-Islamist crackdown on Muslim-majority schools in Birmingham have issued fresh demands for justice after a new investigation revealed that the government may have acted against them based on bogus extremism threat claims. A podcast series published by the New York Times titled The Trojan Horse Affair alleges that numerous players, including Government Minister Michael Gove, penalised several schools and their staff, despite knowing the accusations weren't credible.
Knowing all of these facts and background, he went on to launch an offensive against our schools and brought down what were, you know, highly successful schools within a matter of months. This was a clear abuse of authority and abuse of power, for which I think that people should be held to account.
The Trojan Horse affair began in 2014 after a mysterious letter was sent anonymously to Birmingham Council. The letter outlined a supposed plot by Muslim extremists to infiltrate, take over and radicalise schools. On the back of the letter, inquiries were launched, followed by an Islamophobic media frenzy, which then led to several Muslim teachers being sacked or banned from their work.
What we observed and we witnessed this firsthand was institutional racism, institutional corruption, and institutional Islamophobia. The media had a social responsibility to ensure that there was a balance and a reporting of facts. But this was not the case.
The Muslims targeted say they are victims of a state-backed witch hunt and that the extremism accusations were devastating.
I was unable to get any job. I was even refused voluntary posts. People wouldn't even accept my voluntary work because my name and personality had been stigmatized, I've been vilified, and the label of extremism and radicalism had been attached to my name. So it made me unemployable, quite frankly.
I would also say to Michael Gove, damages and compensation are due, and my ban and the ban of my fellow colleagues need to be lifted immediately.
After spending the day here in Birmingham, it's very clear that the negative effects that the Trojan Horse affair has had on the Muslim community still resonates very strongly. And with the victims' hunger for justice as strong now as it's ever been, the question is, what will be done to hold those who did any wrongdoing during the affair to account going forward? Robert Carter, Birmingham.
Venezuela's president says his country will expand military cooperation with Moscow after high-level discussions with a Russian delegation in Caracas.
We reviewed the powerful military cooperation and confirmed the path of powerful military cooperation between Russia and Venezuela to defend peace and sovereignty. The defense of territorial integrity, a powerful military cooperation.
Maduro said they also discussed ways of boosting cooperation in trade and energy sectors. He also voiced full support for Russia amid tensions over Ukraine, saying Venezuela backs Moscow in its struggle to dispel the threats from the Western world and NATO. The two sides signed various cooperation agreements spanning a number of key fields. Deputy Prime Minister Yuri Borisov, who is heading the Russian delegation, has described Caracas as a strategic partner for Moscow in the region. The Russian delegation is on a three-country trip set to next feature Nicaragua and then wrap up in Cuba. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Scientists say more must be done to eliminate the chemicals which have a devastating impact on marine life and can end up in the food chain. We have prepared for you an article written by David Lucille. The piece is titled, How Forever Chemicals Are Using Marine Life to Travel the World by Sea. When scientists found women in the remote Faroe Islands had unusually high concentrations of toxic industrial chemicals in their breast milk, it seemed a surprising discovery. The North Atlantic archipelago, which lies between Iceland and the northern tip of Scotland, is far from sources of industrial or chemical pollution. And the chemicals that the 2005 Stockholm University study measured, which included polychlorinated biphenyls or PCBs, had already been phased out in many countries. So how did this happen? The chemicals were coming from the ocean, or more specifically, from the pilot whales that make up an important part of the Faroe Islanders' diet. PCBs, or polychlorinated biphenyls, part of a group of toxic chemicals called persistent organic pollutants, or POPs, are able to travel huge distances around the planet through air and water, affecting communities far away from the source of contamination. They make their way into the sea, building up in the fatty tissues of marine animals. Once in the food chain, these chemicals can biomagnify as they pass from prey to hunter, reaching higher concentrations in top predators. That is why it can be riskier to regularly eat large marine animals, such as tuna or pilot whales, in the case of the Faroe Islanders, than, say, mackerel, anchovies or sardines. Inui living in the Canadian Arctic have also been found to have higher POP level in their bloodstream than the general population of Canada, predominantly due to their diet of fish and marine mammals such as walrus and narwhal. What is happening in Canada and in the Faroe Islands is one snapshot of the dangers of a group of chemicals that have, it turns out, an outsized impact on people, wildlife, food chains, and the entire ecosystems. In the 1920s, polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCBs, a family of 209 synthetic industrial chemicals, were developed for use as cooling fluids and flame retardants in machinery, electric goods, paints, and building materials. Stable, non-flammable, and heat-resistant, the chemicals had multiple uses. But that stability, once such a positive attribute, meant they did not disappear or degrade even long after production had ceased. After peaking in the 1960s, use of polychlorinated biphenyls or PCBs began to decline from the 1970s as the health effects became more apparent and countries banned the chemicals. Scientists started to link polychlorinated biphenyls to negative effects on immune systems of animals and people, endocrine disruption, reduced fertility, neurodevelopmental problems, and reduced IQ in children. They have also been classified as a probable carcinogen. Today, most polychlorinated biphenyls or PCBs are found in sealed landfill sites, old electrical equipment, and prefabricated buildings made before the 1980s. Unless you live very close to an industrial or agricultural site, your most likely source of PCBs is your food. A list of 12 persistent organic pollutants, or POPs, known as the Dirty Dozen, including PCBs and the synthetic insecticide DDT, were banned in 2004 by an international treaty, the Stockholm Convention. And more chemicals have since been added. To date, 185 parties have signed a treaty, promising to implement control measures. But even with widespread bans, pollution continues to spread. Some chemicals face production restrictions, such as DDT, which cannot be manufactured or applied as an insecticide in agriculture in most countries, but can still be used to control malaria. Others are being eliminated. The treaty calls for polychlorinated biphenyls or PCBs to be phased out in equipment by 2025, and all PCBs to be eliminated by 2028. But so far, the treaty has not succeeded in turning off the tap for much of this toxic pollution. According to the United Nations Environment Programme, only 17% of the total amount of polychlorinated biphenyls or PCBs has been eliminated worldwide, with 83% or 14 million tons still to be dealt with. An estimated 1 million tons of PCB-contaminated material are waiting to be destroyed in Europe alone. The most effective way to get rid of polychlorinated biphenyls or PCBs is by incineration at extremely high temperatures, an expensive and sometimes logistically impossible process. But unless existing stocks of chemicals are dealt with and disposed of appropriately, they will eventually end up in the environment. Already the ocean acts as a PCB sink, but so far only a tiny proportion of the legacy contaminant has entered the marine environment. As buildings and materials are destroyed and dumped, more polychlorinated biphenyls or PCBs will continue to leach into waterways. The climate crisis may play an aggravating role, speeding up the movement of chemicals around the planet. As temperatures rise, persistent organic pollutants or POPs will evaporate even more easily into the atmosphere. In the future, this grasshopper effect, by which pollutants evaporate in warmer regions and travel in air currents to cooler places, could have an even greater impact on people, animals, and places thousands of miles away from the source of the pollution. A scientific paper by Paul Jepson, a veterinary specialist in wildlife population health at the Zoological Society of London, and his colleagues, published last year, reveals that polychlorinated biphenyls or PCBs were found in every single one of the 1,081 dolphins, porpoises and killer whales they studied. Of these, about 55% of the harbour porpoises, most of the stripped dolphins and bottlenose dolphins and all of the killer whales had higher levels of PCB, levels that were greater than 9 milligrams of PCB per kilogram of their lipid or body fat. It is above this level that traces of PCB can have biological consequences for certain species. But many killer whales have far higher concentrations, typically between 10 and 100 times above the 9 milligram per kilogram threshold. Lulu, the killer whale, had PCBs measuring 957 milligrams per kilogram of lipid. Paul Jepson, a veterinary specialist at the Zoological Society of London, said, "At these levels, species stop reproducing. This probably accounts for why Lulu's pod produced no calves. The nightmare scenario. Ultimately, if species stop reproducing, they become extinct." Studies coming out of the United States are now considering what impact, if any, PCBs may be having on human health. Paul Jepson said, "In the United States, there is a lot of scientific evidence showing the toxic effect of high polychlorinated biphenyls or PCB human health, but this approach has yet to be replicated in Europe." The Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, website acknowledges that people who ingest fish may be exposed to polychlorinated biphenyls or PCBs that have bioaccumulated in the fish they're ingesting. Tackling the problem is a daunting prospect. The chemicals can be destroyed only in high-temperature incinerators, which are found in only a few countries. Polluting per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances that escape into the ocean often come back to shore when released into the air from the sea spray aerosols of crashing waves. This boomerang effect is further evidence that toxic chemicals do not get diluted by the sea. While legislation is slow, more stringent preventive measures are urgently needed to make sure the emerging pollutants in use today will not become the legacy contaminants of the future.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring
event.
In Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to the debate. I'm Kavit Atwayi. An empty shell. That is how Iran's top security official has described the JCPOA. Does this mean that the fate of the JCPOA revival talks is in danger? Well, in this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at whether the parties to the deal, the U.S. and its European partners, can give Iran the guarantees that it is looking for. We will also look at why Israel showed up at the Vienna talks and which party felt the need for it to be present there. Let's first get an update about the talks that are going on, the revival JCPOA revival talks that are going on in Vienna. Of course, one of Homa Leski joins us from there. If we have Homa, can you please tell us what the latest is regarding the JCPOA revival talks?
Yes, Kaveh. We just had a tweet by the Russian lead delegate, Mikhail Ulyanov, and he said that consultations are continuing, intensive discussions almost non-stop, as of course we are reaching, as everyone is saying, the final stages of these negotiations. It looks like it's a make-or-break situation now. Earlier, the Chinese lead delegate also addressed reporters today, and he said, in his words, this is the last stage of the talks, and we are a step away from a final agreement. And he said that he's pleased to say that the sides are taking steps towards each other, of course, meaning the positions that have been expressed, saying that both Iran has come with constructive initiatives on the table following the political decisions that it's already made. And he said that the Europeans and the Americans have also come up with some efforts, and he believes that they are taking steps towards each other, and that the next 1 or 2 days, he said, are going to be quite crucial. We also had earlier, as we said, remarks by the French foreign minister addressed to the Senate, where he said that the onus is now on Iran, that Iran has to make the decision. At the same time, Iranian officials have made it clear that they have already come up with their initiatives. They have already taken the steps necessary. They're not going to go beyond the JCPOA. And now, if the United States particularly makes the decisions, when it comes to guarantees on sanctions removal, verified sanctions removal, and the removal of all of the Trump-era sanctions, including entities and people, individuals who've been sanctioned under the Trump administration for various other reasons that are not directly JCPOA-related, then this is not going to work. And also guarantees the U.S. is not going to withdraw. And at this stage, however, all sides are still saying that a deal is within reach. We'll have to see if that is going to happen. Kaveh.
Indeed. Thank you so much for that. Homa Leski there from Vienna. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. Fouad Izzadi, university professor and political analyst, joins us from the capital, Tehran. Also joining us is Daniel Lazar, journalist and author, who joins us from New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines. featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome to you both. And Fotozadi, let me first start with you and get an idea from you. Our reporter from Vienna, Homolesky, used this American saying, make or break. So what do you think will make this work? What do you think will break it?
Well, the breaking part is easier to do. The United States is in the business of breaking things in general, bombing things and occupying places. And they can do that by continuing the failed policies of the Trump administration, as they have done in the last year since they have been in office. If they continue these maximum pressure tactics that Trump used, the talks are going to fail. That's one option they have. The other option they have is get rid of this addiction to sanctions. The sanctions are not going to cause the overthrow of the Iranian government. Sanctions are not going to cause Iranians to give more concessions to the other side. Sanctions are going to hurt ordinary Iranian citizens, and that's it, which is not a good thing to do. And what the United States needs to do is to decide whether they want to continue the failed policies of the past or realize previous mistakes and correct previous mistakes. If they lift sanctions, if they return to their commitments under JCPOA, then you can have an agreement. If they talk about a longer and a stronger document, if they want to change the text of JCPOA, if they want to find ways of going around their commitments, then the Iranian side is going to be more careful this time. There's this American saying that you fooled me once, shame on you. If you fooled me twice, shame on me. And the Iranians are not going to be fooled twice by the same group.
Indeed. Well, I'm at a loss of words for the third American saying, Daniel Lazar. But Daniel Lazar, you've been obviously following these revival talks, the JCPOA revival talks in Vienna for quite some time. And obviously you're familiar with the news, but we're really at what stage right now? What are we looking at? We're seeing right now in terms of perhaps Iran saying, listen, this ball is in your court. I know some of these statements, some of these stances may sound repetitive, but they're not, because there's been a lot of negotiations taking place. Where do you think we're at right now?
Well, it's very hard to tell because, you know, we're viewing things from the outside. And so we really have no idea what's actually going on inside the negotiating room. But I must say that I have been very skeptical from the very beginning about the success of these talks, and I still am. I think that the mood in the U.S. Makes a U.S. compromise all but impossible. Congress is adamant, extremely hostile to Iran. Nationalism is growing. America is in a very bellicose mood, especially since Afghanistan, the disastrous pullout in August, and even more since the Ukraine crisis. So America is in no mood to compromise, and so therefore I am very skeptical about any chance of these talks ending successfully.
Well, let's talk about the skepticism, but in another way, if we can, Fuadizadi, and that's from the Iranian side, because if anything, they are the ones that need to not only maintain their skepticism because of what has happened before, but they need the guarantees. But are they going to get them? We're talking about the guarantees first and foremost, I think, for the U.S. Next administration to adhere to this deal, let alone the ones that are needed in order for this to even work. What are we looking at from that vantage point of the Iranians on that?
Well, we are looking at Washington that's in chaos. We have the Republican Congress people that are totally opposed to any agreement with Iran. They like to continue the maximum pressure campaign. And then we have some Democrats like Robert Menendez, who is the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee in the U.S. Senate. He talked about Iran for about an hour last week. And one of the demands that he made was that P5 plus one countries, he's asking them to use the snapback mechanism to bring back all sanctions against Iran. And he's a Democrat. He opposed JCPOA last time in 2015. We have Chuck Schumer, who also opposed JCPOA and did not vote for it. He is the majority leader in the U.S. Senate. He was not the majority leader in 2015. He is now. So you have opposition among Democrats inside the U.S. Congress. And if the U.S. returns to the agreement and has the capacity to use the snapback sanction, I don't think next time Robert Menendez will ask P5 plus one countries to use the snapback mechanism. He will pass a law to do that. And they may have enough vote to actually overcome a presidential veto if Biden decides to veto that. So there are a lot of complications in Washington. The United States is designed in that manner. And generally, when there is disagreement between the U.S. Congress and the administration, many times, generally, the U.S. Congress wins because of different reasons. So we have to be very careful with what Robert Malley, the U.S. representative in Vienna, is saying, because we don't know if he's actually representing the United States government as an entity. The U.S. government is divided on these issues. Even within the Biden administration, you had people like Richard Nephew leaving the negotiating team because of what he said, disagreements with the direction. So there's a lot of complications, and that leads the Iranian negotiating team to be much more cautious when it comes to believing what the U.S. side is saying.
Daniel Lazar, what Iran has said. I'm sorry about that, Fuadzadeh. I thought you were done. I apologize. But to follow that train of thought, Daniel Lazar, Iran has said that there's divisions within the U.S., and of course, as Fuadzadeh said there, the two lawmakers there, Chuck Schumer and Bob Menendez, and of course you had the 34 lawmakers led by Senator Ted Cruz. Who is it that's making, let me say it this way, is the team in Vienna that's talking indirectly with Iran representative of what will happen, or is the one in Washington and the lawmakers there the ones that are going to decide, or is there a split?
Well, both sides. I mean, the negotiators in Vienna are there in behalf of the executive branch, the presidency, and the lawmakers are part of the legislative branch, obviously. But the lawmakers, though, do have the power to block any kind of agreement. But also, more importantly, you have to bear in mind that the anti-Iran sentiment, pro-Israeli sentiment is very, very strong in the U.S. The Democrats, for example, are no better than the Republicans in this regard. In fact, in some ways, they actually may be worse. So I just don't see any kind of political support for a successful conclusion to these negotiations. I think that any attempt by the Biden administration to compromise, to eliminate sanctions would lead to a storm of opposition in Washington. I don't think that it would survive that reaction. So I think I'm just, as I said before, to reiterate, I am extremely pessimistic regarding these talks.
Fotis Zadi, we know that the voice of Israel on this, which many consider noise, has been going on for quite some time, but it was somewhat of a shock in a sense, and I'd like to find out from you what you thought when the news came out that there were Israeli diplomats that were in Vienna on the sidelines of these JCPOA revival talks. An Israeli delegation, some called it. I'm curious as to, what, first of all, what you think of it, but whether they were invited or they just, decided to hop on a plane and go to Vienna. What did you think of that?
You know, I think we are getting near the talks. I don't think the talks will continue much longer. And it's a decision time for the other side to decide what to do. And obviously, the Israelis want to influence that decision. That's why they flew to Vienna. They have been flying to Washington also, and they have been lobbying with other members of P5 plus one to actually get what they want, which is causing more difficulties for people in Iran. And
what do you think? If I may jump in there, why do you think they chose to meet with Rafael Grossi and Russia's representative? Why those two?
Well, they need to talk to Mr. Grossi because they want to use the International Atomic Energy Agency to put pressure on Iran. And Russians have been helpful in the last number of months, and they want to reduce the effectiveness of the Russian delegation in actually helping other parties to reach an agreement. So they realize that Russians have been influential, and they want to also cause difficulty with that. And we have Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, that is visiting Israel today and fully supporting anti-Iran policies of Israel, and stating again that they're going to be in one front against Iran. So when we see that, when we see the latest resolution by Bob Menendez and Senator Graham, Lindsey Graham, about the idea of Iran not enriching any uranium inside the country, and then they say that even if Iran accepts that, they want to continue sanctions on Iran for other reasons. And they also, in that resolution, call for the U.S. Congress to approve whatever agreement the executive branch of the United States makes in Vienna. So we have all these data points that make people in Tehran much more cautious with regard to what the other side is actually doing.
I've never understood, maybe Daniel Lazar, you can enlighten us as to why Israel really is so much against this. I mean, we know some of the reasons, obviously, but when you take a look at what this JCPOA revival talks will do, in essence, it is something that obviously Iran will fall in line with what the JCPOA was. And Israel should be somewhat satisfied about that. But yet it has gone out of its way, obviously, to try to derail the talks, for lack of a better word. My question to you here is that this delegation was an Israeli foreign ministry official, and you also had the Israeli regime's envoy to the IAEA there. How can he be telling the IAEA, when Israel has nuclear warheads and is not an NPT member, of what to do here?
Yeah, it's quite bizarre. It's quite arrogant. You're quite right. But Israel's attitude towards Iran is one of maximum hostility. Israel sees Iran as its chief enemy in the Middle East, and therefore it wants to do whatever it can to hurt, harm, retard, isolate the Iranian state. And therefore, it uses all its influence in Washington to persuade the U.S. to do the same. And Israel has been very effective, but America is very hostile to Iran on its own account. Listen, Americans don't know anything about Iran, nothing at all. They can barely find it on the map. But one thing every American knows is the 1979-80 embassy takeover. I guarantee you of that. Those memories are still fresh. They will be fresh for years to come. And that is ultimately the source of the great hostility in the U.S. towards Iran.
Well, I'm guessing, Fouad Azadi, that one thing that Americans also can't forget, especially the Treasury Department, is how ineffective the sanctions have been. And I'm going to come in here with a tweet of which Ali Shamkhani said, the Supreme National Security Council director, "It is not possible to promise to lift the sanction that has become ineffective in order to score a point." So I'm sure the American side knows that. Why are they continuing with their sanction regime?
Well, they don't know any other thing. It seems that U.S. foreign policy is just sanctions and sanctions and sanctions, even when they don't achieve foreign policy goals. The U.S. Foreign policy has become one-dimensional, creating hostility and then sanctioning the other side. That's the basic formula. And the difficulty that exists is that when you continue this sanctions policy, sooner or later, that policy will fail, as Mr. Shamkhani mentioned today, that Iran selling a lot of oil as we speak and getting the money back. So the other side promising lifting of sanctions when the sanctions have become ineffective is not going to be very attractive, given the fact that the other side in Washington is clueless with regard to what they want to do with their Iran policy and all the disagreements that they have. Another important piece of news today, I think, was Iran's foreign minister interview with the Financial Times, requiring the U.S. Congress to have a vote on the nuclear talks. I think that's very important. Before Iran reaches an agreement, we need to know what the U.S. Congress thinks about the agreement, because we realize that they have the power to influence the direction that the U.S. executive branch takes. And if the U.S. Congress is represented by people like Bob Menendez or Lindsey Graham, then we realize that whatever Robert Malley tells the Iranian delegation in Vienna is not really going to be implemented. And last time, the U.S. stayed in the nuclear agreement for about 2.5 years. This time, given what we have been talking about, I'm not sure if they managed to stay in the nuclear agreement for 2.5 months. And that's the cause of concern, and that's why you see Iranian officials are becoming quite doubtful about the value of the nuclear agreement.
Well, one of the things that has resulted, Daniel Lazar, over the course of time, that's been expanding, is the scope of Iran's gravitation towards the East. And in particular, we could talk about, obviously, number one, China, and then Russia along with that. The trade bloc, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, another example where Iran joined, and just the expansion of these trade relations, which brings about this sanctions-proof shield for Iran, making sanctions ineffective. The U.S. realizes that, I am sure. So therefore, shouldn't that be a factor in the decision-making for the U.S.?
Well, it should be a factor, of course, but it's not. I mean, America is in a very bad situation. From 1989 until 2001, or even later, America, it was the great unipolar moment for America. America ruled the world. Its word was law. Its power was overwhelming. And really, it was in a position that no other imperial power had ever attained before. And now politicians are desperate to get back to the to somehow recapture that golden moment. And that is Biden's mission. Biden's slogan is America is back, and that he wants to turn the clock back to that golden age. And so, you know, so whereas it would make sense for the U.S. to compromise with Iran, you know, if only to, you know, to sort of calm down one theater of operations.
Sure. I got to unfortunately jump in, and I'm sorry about that. Gifwet Azadi, just 30 seconds that we have left in time. Fouad Azadi, in closing, your statements, please.
You know, I think your other guest in New York was getting to the right point that he was making. I think he was making a very important statement that President Biden is not Obama and John Kerry is not around. We have Tony Blinken, and people make a difference. And the goal of the current administration is something different from what we saw before, and you're going to see the result that's going to be different.
Thank you very much for that. I do apologize for cutting you off there, Daniel Azar. Unfortunately, again, we're fresh out of time. Fouad Azadi there, university professor and political analyst. Thank you for your contribution. Daniel Azar, pleasure, journalist and author from New York. And that does it for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikava Tahveh and the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Back to reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, sisters and brothers from every single corner of the world, wherever you are, I hope you're doing well and everything is fine with you. This is IRIB English Radio, and today I have the privilege to be your host. I am Asma, and with us, we have two dear friends and guests in the studio. Welcome, brothers. Would you please introduce yourself to us?
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Brother Habib at your service, representing California.
So, welcome.
My name is Sayyid Abdul Al-Musawi, and I am from the land down under.
Okay, that's very good. Welcome to the program. So pleased to have you here. Well, we're all buckled up for you to take us back to reality. We are going to have a very interesting topic today. I know that both of our guests have been to movies or they have read books. When you read a book, which one does attract you more, the form or the content? The chapters of the book, how they have been put.
The exterior look
Yes, the exterior
the
look. And the
interior information content of it.
Not like to judge the book by its cover, like it's red, it's green. No, the way that they ordered the things.
Yes.
Well, obviously, it depends who you are. I mean, content does matter, but form does also matter. Because sometimes you could have beautiful content, but if the form itself is messed up, it just turns you off.
Yes, you know both are so very important.
If you take a movie, for example, sometimes you could have a Hollywood blockbuster with millions of dollars spent on it. But if you see that the storyline, it's really messed up. It doesn't matter how good the action scene or stuff is. It's still like, I was watching, let me give you an example. I was watching The Matrix lately,
yes.
The last one. I'm the biggest Matrix fan in the planet of Earth. And I love the first Matrix and the second one. The second one, not as well. The last one, I'm like, what in God's name have they done, right?
Yes.
So there is a lot of science fiction stuff happening, but the storyline, the content was so messed up.
So by form, we meant the way it has been put out.
Yeah.
Not the content, the main thing that the director or the writer is going to tell us.
Yeah.
That exactly happens to human beings as well.
We are the same. Sometimes
yes,
you look at a
same.
Person from the outside, they look like a mu'min,
yes.
Beautiful person, very well designed and very well mannered.
You sit with them. When you dig deeper.
When you talk with them for about half an hour, you realize what For example, if we're talking about art factors or, you know, like literature and reading, personally, when reading, I mostly like the content of hadith, and I really don't care about the forms or the form manner. I just want to read. And sometimes, no, I have this study in my mind that I want to do or this research that I need. For example, I have this research and I have to read one of the books that I don't like to read. But I need the order that they go on by, and I need the form order that